Today is the 16th of January, and it is 2007, and we are talking to Jeff Winningham. Jeff, why don't you share, to go back in the beginning, focusing once again on our memories of Houston in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. Let's go back to when you came to Houston.
I came to Houston, Sally, in the fall of 1961. I was accepted as an undergraduate student at Rice, thinking at the time that I would be an engineering major. And I came to Rice in the fall of 61, getting here 1 week before, was it Alicia, the hurricane?
Probably.
Yeah. And at that time, Rice didn't even have an art department, and I certainly didn't have any interest in, nor any thought of any kind, of pursuing art, even as far as one course. I was an engineering major to be, but shortly after I got here, I became an English major. There were a few art courses taught in architecture by Charles Shorey and Eleanor Evans. My recollection is that was the extent of the visual arts on the Rice campus. And I wasn't someone, as I said, that was keenly interested in the arts at that time, so I really can't talk about the art community in general. I was a student here. I developed, redeveloped an interest in photography that I had first developed as a teenager. I began photographing and taking pictures for the school newspaper and the yearbook. And I did that for my freshman and my sophomore year. Then my junior year, when I was an English major, is when my first kind of stirrings about visual art began to happen within me. And I was in an English course with Walter Isle, and I noticed him making references to photography, relating them to literature. Well, that was a total new thing to me, because I was basically just a kind of a hobbyist. Mm-hmm. Photography was a craft that I had learned and continued to employ. But, you know, when he would talk about, for example, poetry of T.S. Eliot and make references to the photographs of Walker Evans, that didn't have any meaning to me, but I pursued it, followed it up. And so my first interest in art began on the Rice campus, stirred really by, first of all, English profs, particularly Walter Isle, in that department here. My first kind of epiphany in the area of photography came when a fellow named Larry McMurtry, mm-hmm. who was a big buddy of Walter Isle's, came up to me in the hall one day in Anderson Hall and said, you that photographer guy? I said, yep. He said, my name's Larry McMurtry and I work at a bookstore over on San Felipe and I just got a book in. You should come by and see it. I said, what is it? He said, well, just come by, I'll show it to you. Well, I went by a few days later. It was a copy of The Decisive Moment, the landmark Cartier-Bresson book. And I remember opening that book and being spellbound by it for several hours and going away with the feeling that was what I wanted to do the rest of my life. The other person that was very important in the developing of my interest in my photography and in art in general was Charles Shorey. Shorey taught a kind of a free-for-all class that was sponsored by the architecture department. It was, I think, technically called drawing and watercolor rendering. It was specifically meant to teach architects how to render. But in Shorey's inimitable way, he kind of took it in all directions and took people like me who had never taken an art course and allowed me to take pictures in the class. And it just became a really wonderful kind of special problems class where everybody had their own special problem and we all worked on it and we showed them together. Shorey became a mentor, a friend. He loaned me copies of Aperture magazine. He would loan me books. And he, more than anyone else, is the one that made me aware that there was a tradition and a history to photography as an art. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say that during my first 5 years in Houston, from 1961 through 1966, that that course that Shorey taught and his mentoring me, and then Walter Isle's kind of referring me to the literature of photography, They were really the two influences that were most important to me. Now, I hear people at the museum now talk about their first photography show. In 1964, I saw the show they hung of a really marvelous news photographer who worked for the Chronicle named Ted Rozumovsky. He had a one-person show at the MFA. I believe the year would have been 1964. I saw that. It was my first kind of the first museum show I had seen of photography. But my point being that museums were generally not showing photography. Photography was not taught at Rice nor at any other institution of higher education or institution of art at Rice. So it was kind of a desert of interest, particularly in photography. I went away to grad school. I went to Chicago to the Institute of Design at Illinois Institute of Technology, kind of descendant of the Bauhaus. I had two great years of study and learning there. Studied with Aaron Siskin and Arthur Siegel and Wynn Bullock. It was a great two-year education. My last year there, I taught in a high school, a Nutrier High School, east in Winnetka, Illinois. And then...
Were you teaching photography?
I was teaching photography.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I'd gone to school, to grad school, with the idea, believe it or not, that I'll give this a try. And if it doesn't work, I'll try something else. I had been accepted to law school at Vanderbilt, where my father and two of my brothers and uncle had all gone. And this was like, I'm going to try this out. I love to do photography, and I thought I'll just try and see where it goes. But it was one of those things where I could not have planned or even hoped for what happened next. I got out of IIT with my master's degree in the spring of 1968, and right at that time, another English prof who had befriended me and had been a very close friend of mine, Jerry O'Grady, was hired by Jean Dumanil to start a media center at the University of St. Thomas. And the media center, the name being as confusing to me as it probably is to you, I mean, what was a media center? O'Grady was a kind of a disciple of Marshall McLuhan, the mm-hmm. medium is the message. And in his mind, one of the great tasks for higher education at that time was to help everyone be more aware of how media worked. Media being defined by McLuhan mostly as television, but also film, and to a certain degree, published photography, as in Life magazine, mm-hmm. other magazines. All right. So O'Grady was starting this media center at the University of St. Thomas with the enthusiastic patronage of Jean Dumanil. I don't think Dominique was particularly excited about it, nor was she opposed to it. She was doing her own thing, her Institute for the Arts. This was Jean Dumanil's thing. And I had an interview with the Dumanils in New York in the late spring of 1968, and I was hired. Started teaching in the fall of 1968. Well, I have to tell you that that year, that first really and only year of teaching at St. Thomas, because as you know, the whole program moved to Rice in 69, that year was an astonishing year. Astonishing in the following ways. First of all, we were able to buy whatever equipment we wanted. There was no budget to teach.
You were in heaven, Jeff.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I could do whatever I wanted in the way of setting up courses, and we could take students from the greater community. They didn't even have to be full-time or even part-time University of St. Thomas students. They could come in and enroll for one class. I had this, David Attucks took my class. A woman named Fran Brennan from New Orleans took my class. I remember it was just this great potpourri of people from all over the community of virtually all ages, from high schoolers up. And then I was told it would be a good idea to have a guest artist program in the second semester, and that the Museum of Modern Art was ready and willing to loan us a show if I could simply identify what we would like to have to come to the campus to present as a show. I mean, 1 year out of graduate school.
You probably thought, gosh, this is the way life works.
No, Well, you know, that guest artist series there, it was actually guest artists and curators, was astonishing. I look back and who was in it, Robert Frank, mm-hmm. Jerry Uthman, Frederick Summer, Arthur Siegel, John Sharkovsky, Peter Bunnell, Nathan Lyons. It was just the most important and most interesting range of people you could have come up with at that time. And they came and they spoke and or showed their work. They critiqued my students' work. It was quite
marvelous.
Quite a way to start a first year of instruction. And then, of course, there was the parting of ways of the DeMonnells and the St. Thomas administration. And to complete the cycle, in the early spring of 1969, Jerry O'Grady came to me and said, we're all moving to Rice. Who are we? He said, well, James Blue, who had started teaching film, the whole art history faculty there, Bill Camphill, Walter mm-hmm. Widrig, Nino Badner, Philip Oliver Smith, the slide librarian, Pat Toomey, and the question was, would you like to go too? And it's not that they could guarantee that I would go, but the first question was, would you like to? And then I don't know whose muster I had to pass in order, but I did. And so by the end of the 68-69 academic year, we were on our way to Rice. And this building, the Media Center, started construction in the fall of 1969. The Institute for the Arts opened seemingly overnight. I mean, they built that building next door to us, which is now continuing studies, in the late spring and summer of 1969. And all of a sudden, Dominique was in it and having shows. And then we were like 6 months behind that.
Where did you office in the interim? Where did you teach?
We actually taught Rice courses in the fall of 69 at the University of St. Thomas. We had a little building on Mount Vernon Street. And that building, which we had converted to dark rooms and studio and classroom, was still operational. And I taught Rice-sponsored courses, part of the Department of Fine Arts at Rice University, chaired by John O'Neill, in that same location in the fall of 69. And in the spring of 1970, we moved into this building, which was then and is still today, as far as I'm concerned, the best working teaching facility in film and photography I've seen anywhere. Just a dream of a space. Eugene Aubrey designed it with James Blue and I working with him on the specs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wow, what a first 2 years. Really
well,
astonishing
that's right.
First 2 years, you know.
And you're a young man.
Very young man. Very young. Younger than I knew at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the kind of amazing thing for me looking back is that somehow in the midst of all of that challenge to come up with courses. I had taught high school, but I'd never taught a college course before that first course at St. Thomas. All of a sudden, you know, I was also out of graduate school and now not working toward a thesis or certainly toward any course requirements. I was a working artist. I was a photographer out, you know, to make a career. And I just really look back on it and see it as partly some blind luck. I got some breaks. You know, having John Sharkovsky and Peter Bunnell and Nathan Lyons come to your place to teach also meant that they then knew who you were, saw your work, or at least were prepared to see your work. So I made this extraordinary range of contacts. And the work that I began to do in 68-69 was kind of an extension of what I'd done in grad school, very experimental kind of Bauhaus type work,
mm-hmm.
experimenting with the materials of photography. And it never really was my forte. I always was and still am basically what some would call a documentary photographer. I would call it a descriptive photographer. I'm interested in describing the world, not creating one
mm-hmm.
on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And within the couple of years after getting my degree from IIT and being back here in Houston, within a couple of years, my work began to move back into its more natural vein. That is to say, I began to explore and to photograph what was around me rather than trying to create original stuff in photography. the lecture series, the guest artist series, continued at Rice. I met and invited Gary Winogrand, Lee Friedlander, and they were enormously influential in terms
Absolutely.
Of my work. And so then in the spring of 1971, I kind of hatched this plan. I had come to be a great fan, admirer of the photographs of Ouija, Arthur Fellig, the New York news photographer, Ouija and his naked city photographs of New York and naked Los Angeles. And there was a kind of a lack of pretense, a kind of artlessness about his work that I just loved. And so at some point, late fall of 70 or early 1971, I remember specifically saying to myself, I love this city, and nobody can see it like I can. And so I am going to kind of be Houston's Ouija. There are crowds gathered where there's a party or a protest or any other sort of public gathering where there's likely to be some spark and energy. It's my business to be there. And so that's what I began to photograph. And I photographed, everything from performers like Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis. If they were in town, I'd be there. Somehow I'd talk my way or sneak in to photograph. If a politician was speaking, I'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a ribbon cutting, I would be there. And then one afternoon reading the newspaper, I saw where Johnny Valentine and Wahoo McDaniel were going to fight, quote unquote, in the Houston Coliseum on Friday night. And, that was one of those things, wrestling, that I always knew was there. I grew up with it in Tennessee. I knew wrestling happened, but I'd never really thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
So on that Friday night, I went down to the Houston Coliseum. I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration to say my life, at least my photographic life, kind of changed. There was the subject I'd looked for. There was what I wanted, light, action, powerful emotion, great drama.
Good sweat.
Yeah, good sweat. And most of all, real art, folk art. I convinced myself shortly after beginning my weekly visits to the Coliseum on Friday night that if Shakespeare were alive and well, he'd be writing scripts for the wrestling matches. So I photographed wrestling, and then, as soon as I kind of finished with that and did a book about that. Oh, now that's a great story. This is pure Houston story. I got to tell you this one. I got, 9 months into this photography of wrestling in the Coliseum, and I had some good pictures. I knew I did, and it was coming toward a book. I knew it was. It was really looking good. I showed it in New York in the summer of 71. I took it to Peter Bunnell at the Museum of Modern Art, and he and John Sarkowski both kind of flipped over it. So I'm thinking, wow, this is going well. So I came back determined to try to finish the book that fall, and I worked on it for about a month or two into October, maybe early November. And I thought, okay, I got to make a book of this. Where am I going to find a publisher? Where am I going to find the money? How am I going to do this? I was totally wet behind the ears, totally green. I'd never done a book, never thought about doing a book. When I had been at Rice as a student, I had edited the yearbook, the Camp Neely. And the publisher's representative for the yearbook, a man named Jess Allison, Dan Allison's father.
Hmm.
Jess Allison was our rep, and he sold class rings and yearbook printing. And we became big buddies. We really kind of liked each other. And Jess told me, as the yearbook was finished in 1964, one of these days you're going to come up with a set of photographs and you're going to want to publish them, and I want you to find me when you do, he said, then we'll publish them. He said that to me kind of as I went away to grad school, actually, a little bit after the yearbook was published. And so Jess Allison popped back in my mind in 1971, and I had kind of stayed in touch with him. So one afternoon, I took a box of my wrestling photographs over to his office on Allen Parkway. We hadn't seen each other in some time, and I said, "Jess, I have a book now." "What's it about?" And I said, "Well, it's about professional wrestling."
Okay. I remember this kind of dumb thing he did, like, "What?"
Okay, and I was ready to open the box and show him the prints, and he said, in so many words, "Well, I don't need to see the pictures. If you tell me they're good, I know they are." He said, "How many should we print?" And then I said, "I don't know, what, about 10,000? And he said, "Well, what do you think it'll cost us per book?" And I said, "I don't know. We need to find out." So we went over to Jack Wetmore at Wetmore. They priced the book.
Well, did you talk to Mac or Jack?
Jack first, Mac ultimately, of course. Okay. Came down to almost exactly a dollar a book, $10,000. Well, that was a huge amount of money in 1971.
Well, of course it was.
Okay. Jess thought about it for about 5 or 10 seconds and said, "Well, let's do it." Okay, so...
Well, you had angels just hovering over you constantly.
I know. But, you know, I remember after Friday Night in the Coliseum came out, the book, and then Going Texan a year later, when I visited New York, Magnum called me, the big picture agency. Magnum, Cartier-Bresson's agency. Uh-huh. And they wanted to visit with me. And basically, what they wanted to know was, how was I getting these books done? And I remember telling the then director of Magnum this story about Jess Allison.
Mm-hmm.
I thought she would fall out of her chair.
Mm-hmm.
Here was this.
That's Houston, Texas for you.
This is Houston. That's why I'm there. It's part of why I'm there. And it's a very, very important thing in my mind. It is why I was there, because I could operate.
Mm-hmm.
There was that wonderful attitude of, you know, go for it. We'll
mm-hmm.
make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He never looked at the pictures. You could say, "Well, that's stupid." But you know what? He just felt...
But he knew you already. He knew you.
It was just that kind of faith in me as a person. It's pure Houston, you know, I think.
I think it's pure Houston.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, we printed 10,000 books.
Now, meanwhile, you are teaching all the while. All the while.
Yes.
Of course. Okay,
teaching.
Go ahead.
And by now, things are really starting to happen. You know, word had trickled down from the Museum of Modern Art. Jean Dumanil cornered me one day, who had really never paid much attention to me. I was Jerry O'Grady's guy. Jean Dumanil was interested in film. He wasn't really interested in still photography, but he was on the photography committee at the Museum of Modern Art. So one night, Jean Dumanil said to me, after some sort of program, a speaker at St. Thomas, "Hey, Jeff, Jean Sarkowski speaks very well of your photographs." I said, "Really?" He said, "Oh, yes. He says you're the best thing since Alfred Stieglitz."
That's pretty good.
Well, I can hear John saying it, you know. What he was doing, if he said that, which I wouldn't put past him, was he was really kind of putting a dig at Alfred Stieglitz for all of his preciousness and, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe's lovely hands. Here I am out photographing wrestling. That's John's kind of thing, okay? Okay, so... you know, Friday Night in the Coliseum, we printed 10,000 copies. A lot of them got damaged in the bookbinding. Emmett Bookbinders had never bound a book like this before, and they messed up a lot of them. So my recollection is, well, we printed 10,000. We were going to bind like 4,000, but about 2,000 of them got destroyed in the binding. So we ended up with like 1,800 saleable books, and in the first year we sold probably... 50. We were up against the hard reality of marketing books,
mm-hmm.
okay? And particularly marketing books on a kind of a fringe subject like Friday Night in the Coliseum. So I got, you know, my angels were in place, but so was the hard reality of
selling books.
Of selling books, of selling work at all. I mean, I would say probably in the first 5 years of my photography, from 71 to 76. Which was a very, very productive time for me. I probably didn't sell 5 photographs, and not many more than 5 books.
Well, I met you in 78 or 9.
Is that when it was?
Probably.
That sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, uh-huh. Well, you know, it's a proud tradition of books that don't sell, starting with Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. So I'd like to think, not that I compare my work to that book, but just in the sense that really good books don't always sell. It's a fact of life. And Friday Night in the Coliseum is now a very collectible book. I saw a copy on the internet the other day, a soft cover copy for over $500.
Good heavens.
I only have two of them. I mean, they're very rare, and you know, certainly of all my work, it's the most collectible book. But at the time, I couldn't give them away. I literally couldn't give them away. They were a storage problem. And then I did, 6 years later, the book on high school football, Rites of Fall. University of Texas Press thought, this is going to be a great book. It's going to make our year financially. High school football, everybody in Texas loves high school football. We're going to sell one of these to every third Texan. You know, well, they printed 10,000 of those. And they sold them all before the 1st of November. And by the 1st of March of the next year, all but about 200 had come back. The bookstores have the right of return. And my book on high school football was not what they were waiting for in Kilgore, Texas. They wanted to see the glory of high school football. And mine was the eccentricities and the wrinkles and the wonderful curiosities of it that were kind of lost on folks in Kilgore now. Anyway, I've kind of gotten ahead of myself and off the track here, but we got onto the subject of books. And, you know, I do feel, I did feel, and I still feel, literally, blessed to have begun my career and even to be continuing my career in Houston. I think it's a place where things have happened for me that literally would never happen anywhere else. Very, very unlikely.
Let's go back a minute and describe to us the Institute for the Arts. You know, what was it like to get started, to be in this building and coming in? I mean, what were the students like? What was the faculty? What did it feel like, taste like, and smell like? What was going on? Besides Mrs. Dimonil coming in to curate exhibitions.
Well, of course, that was huge. I mean, being next door to that operation was of a thousand times more important than being on the Rice campus.
Mm-hmm.
Because the media center, from its arrival on the Rice campus, from the time of its arrival, was regarded with some misgivings, or, well, what is this all about? I mean, there was very little art here beforehand. John O'Neill had started the Department of Fine Arts, and David Parsons was teaching some sculpture, and John O'Neill was teaching some painting, but the students really were not coming to Rice expecting to take art courses. But boy, did they line up for the film and photography classes. They lined up in long lines. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So from day one, we had many more students than we could take into the photo classes. I took 20 students per class. I'm not sure what James Blue did in film, but fewer than that, but probably 10 or 12 at a time. We just, we couldn't meet the demand. Why couldn't we meet the demand? I think two things. First of all, because the time was beginning to arrive. We were on the early, early wave of the arrival of photography in the universities across this country as a viable and important visual art form that should be offered within the studio curriculum. And students were ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
It was beginning to happen. Museums were starting to form collections. The Museum of Fine Arts was beginning to have photo shows. St. Thomas and now Rice were beginning to teach photography. It was, but we were really were on one of the very first waves. You know, now every self-respecting art department has photography, whether it's a state university or a private school. But, you know, Rice was really in the front there before photography was taught, to my knowledge, at any other college or university across the state. There may have been something I'm not aware of, but I think we were the first. I also started a little art gallery, I mean a little photography gallery over on Bissonnette. That was Jack Wetmore and I's partnership, the Leighton Image. It didn't last long. Now, you could have walked into Leighton Image in 1969 and bought an Ansel Adams print for $75 for an 11x14 or $150 for a 16x20.
Wow.
We only sold two. Yeah. So, but it was starting. You know, it was starting. The acceptance, the enthusiastic embracing of photography as a viable art form.
When you came back to Rice, or came over to Rice with the St. Thomas contingent, were you visiting art galleries? Were you, and you know, what were your observations of Houston as a city in the arts at that time?
Well, you know, my first reaction to that, Sally, is that I was so still so relatively inexperienced in terms of my knowledge and experience of the arts across the country in general that I don't know that I don't really have a good answer to that. I was a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And I do remember this, that I very distinctly prided myself on not being an artist. I was a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And that difference was huge, and still is in many ways, but thankfully I've softened on it a little bit. But I felt that photography had such a special place with such a different kind of art that at that time I really wasn't keen on visiting art galleries and seeing shows of painting. I remember, you know, there was this fantastic parade of exhibitions that Dominique DeMille had next door. Whether it was the Larry Rivers, this is the most memorable one to me, the Larry Rivers curated show, Some American History, which had to do the history of the black man in the United States. In retrospect, it was a great show.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I remember looking at it and thinking, so much style, not much substance, because the most powerful things in that show were not Larry Rivers' constructions or anybody else's stylized kind of paintings, but the photographs of the lynchings. This just reinforced my mind, you know, art's art, but photography is something else. So I didn't really spend a lot of time visiting galleries. I got as often as I could to New York
mm-hmm.
to see the couple of photo galleries that had been founded there. I got as often as I could to, not so much Los Angeles, but to San Francisco, where the Franco Gallery had been founded. So I stayed kind of in touch with and made it my business to look at those early photo galleries. You know, it wasn't until I married a painter that painting really became of any great interest to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the truth of the matter.
Mm-hmm.
Despite my great friendship with Charles Shorey, his forays into photography interested me more than his paintings.
Let's talk about some of the people in your life tapestry during that period of time in Houston that stand out and that, for whatever reasons, made a real difference to you in some way.
You know, someone that just came to mind that I should mention. It was so much a part of my life at the time, I tend to forget it. But, you know, Texas Monthly started, I believe, in 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Broyles, who had been not a close friend, but a friend at Rice, was the founding editor. Greg Curtis, who had been a fellow student at Rice in the same class as Broyles, one year behind me, was the first managing editor. You know, an important thing to me in terms of getting me out and around and extending my my turf beyond Houston was Texas Monthly. And it was a source of publication. It was a source of gratification and encouragement. I guess I did probably 3 to 6 photo essays a year for Texas Monthly in those early years. And it was really important when I look back. For example, my interest in high school football, which became a 5-year kind of long love for me, started in 1975 when Bill asked me to check out this school up in East Texas, maybe. He said, you might be interested in going up to Big Sandy, Texas, where they haven't lost a football game in like 4 years and the coach is the mayor. So, you know, the next weekend I'm in my car on my way to Big Sandy. I mean, it was a great...
Open doors
for me. Texas Monthly was hugely important to
mm-hmm.
me at that time. The day-to-day kind of connection I had that was important to me, I think, was James Blue. And then he had a colleague, David McDougall. The two of them taught film here during the early to mid-70s. And James taught me what bit of documentary filmmaking that I learned. I did 2 documentaries in the 70s. In 1972, I did a 30-minute film on professional wrestling, same subject I had done in still photographs. Then in 1975, I completed a film on the 10th anniversary of the Astrodome. titled The Pleasures of the Stately Dome, which was kind of a look at Roy Hoffines and what he had done there, and the whole Astrodome thing is kind of folk theater. But James, you know, was a real mentor. He, you know, was terrifically encouraging, taught me what I learned of shooting film and editing. So he was a very important colleague and influence in those times. The other influence, and I forget exactly which year Gary Winogrand first taught at the University of Texas, but it was around 1975. And in the couple of years prior to that, we had gotten to know each other a bit. I became a great admirer of Gary's work, and it had a huge influence on my work. And when Gary was at the University of Texas, roughly 1975 to 79, I would be in Austin often, talking with Texas Monthly, doing work with them, seeing Gary. Gary and I would take off to Laredo, Texas. Gary loved parades, and we would always photograph the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo Parade together in Houston. We would always go to Laredo for the George Washington's birthday parade. Like a couple of kids, you know, just, there's going to be a parade. We got to be there, you know. And, you know, Gary's kind of gusto, his incredible appetite for all that stuff that happens, that was very contagious, you know. Just feeding off of his tremendous energy for all the wonderful things that the real world gives you.
Exactly.
That was, you know, has never left me, never will. You know, I'll never get excited about fabricating something to be photographed. Why would I, you know?
Right.
It's just too amazing to sit back and watch what really happens out there. And so that, I just can't overestimate the importance of that with Gary. The other influence, hand in hand with that, John Sarkowski's book, The Photographer's Eye, came out around 1972 or 73. I'm not sure the exact year. I think it came into my hands around 1972. And that was terrifically inspiring and encouraging. I mean, one of the things he writes in there, that the photographer learns that the world itself is an artist of incomparable inventiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just, it's amazing how just a sentence can lift you
mm-hmm.
and push you forward with enthusiasm and energy. And so, you know, it's a great, great book. And, you know, meeting Winogrand, being around James Blue, who was, again, an energetic and exciting teacher and filmmaker. It was a really powerful time.
Very powerful. What about your museum show?
In 1974, I did a show, a one-person show at the MFA. At the time, the MFA sometimes talked about it as their first photography show, but as I've already said, it was not.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Rosomofsky at least had at least one show before that. But there was an associate curator at the museum at that time. I think Philippe de Montebello was the director at the time. And E.A. Carmine was an associate curator. And he got in touch with me, and I remember he said to me, it's funny how words stick in your mind. In one of his first, if not first, conversation with me, he said, I have located you in the documentary tradition. So anyway, working with Carmine, we edited a show of about, I want to say, 50 or 60 prints. And they did a very nice catalog with an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I regard that show as, in many ways, the most important show I've done. It was a deeply encouraging thing to have that happen. And,
was it well balanced in content? Did it show various, like the wrestlers?
Exactly. Uh-huh. It was a little bit of all of that craziness that I had begun to photograph as Houston's Ouija. And you know, I just thought of something else really quite important, and that is that my little effort at starting a photo gallery had long since closed, a year and a half after it opened. But I believe it was in either 74 or 75 that Tony Cronin
mm-hmm.
and his wife Robin opened their gallery here in Houston.
I think it was 75 or 6.
because I came in 75, and I remember it opening.
Well, in 76, they published the first portfolio I did called The Texas Dozen. So I'm thinking they opened in 75, but it could have been early 76. I'm not sure.
Well, it could have been 74. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway.
So, you know, they existed for how long? Several years.
Mm-hmm.
Tony died in a car wreck.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a blow that Robin couldn't carry on after with the gallery.
No.
It was too much for her, herself, though she did for maybe a couple of years. I'm not sure when they closed. But anyway, Cronin Gallery came along in those years.
The Mancini Gallery was in there, too.
That's right. That's
showing
right.
Photography.
Oh, I forgot Mancini Gallery.
Down there underneath the Plaza Hotel.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Right. Wow, I've really forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. What other thoughts do you have, Jeff?
Well, I guess one thought is just looking around now at how many organizations, galleries, institutions there are in one way or another, showing photography, advancing photography, promoting photography. It's such a different environment. It's kind of hard to remember how it was in the early to mid-70s. You know, that there was a little happening. Now you've got, you know, PhotoFest, which is a huge worldwide enterprise, and a great enterprise, it seems to me, both for the city and for the country. It brings so many people here at least every other year. It's a huge part of Houston. HCP, Houston Center for Photography, is an ongoing kind of important venue. Neither of these existed. I'm not sure exactly when HCP came into being, but it was not by the mid-70s, I don't believe. And I'm not sure when George Krause started the program at U of H, probably late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So in many ways, it's a very, very rich kind of environment now for photography in Houston, in art in general. And photography has changed in many ways. One way which strikes me virtually every day is how much visual art in a traditional sense, painting, drawing, collage, has merged with photography to the point that my kind of photography, if you will, kind of straight photography, I hesitate to use the word pure photography, but that's really what we're talking about. Photography unalloyed with other media has become very small in its impact. You know, when you look at the work that's being exhibited in galleries now, the photography work, most of it is some sort of mix with other media.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. It's just quite different than what I was doing in the 70s and what I do today. I mean, nowadays, the other huge change in photography, the biggest change probably in the history of photography, is the digital revolution, the digital tsunami that has swept over the medium. And it, to me, is both terribly exciting and also a cause for great caution. exciting in the way that, it, you know, Photoshop alone is nothing less than God's gift to photographers. You know, it just becomes possible to do things in the way of, you know, adjustments, color corrections, tonal adjustments. What Ansel Adams spent half of a lifetime developing, the zone system, you can now teach a student to do very effectively on the computer in a week, maybe 2 or 3 days, because it is so simple, really,
mm-hmm.
with Photoshop. That's not talking about really manipulating the photograph, destroying its veracity. It's just talking about subtle tonal adjustments, okay? The other, and so digital imaging, digital technology and photography seems to me, first of all, to be hugely important and an opportunity for a photographer like me, who still wants to do straight pictures, to realize those pictures elegantly and beautifully in a way that it could have never done before. Yeah. Prints on papers you could have never printed on before. Prints on other surfaces like aluminum you could have never done before.
Scale.
Scale. That's probably the biggest factor of all. You
mm-hmm.
know, you can make big prints beautifully now. Just for someone who wants to still make straight photographs,
digital is the opening of 100 doors, all of which lead in interesting directions. So I spend a lot of my time in digital scanning, which I'm pretty good at now, and printing, which I'm pretty good at, getting better. Digital shooting still doesn't interest me because it doesn't interest me much. It's gaining. But still, digital shooting, it seems to me, is mostly about convenience, getting there faster. It's about not losing something because you were making an error, which digital feedback could have showed you right away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are convenience things about digital shooting. But when someone comes along with a 35mm camera, digital, that I can make better pictures with, then I'll really get interested. Right now, the most you can say is, it's just about as good as film. And that's not good enough yet to
mm-hmm.
really get your interest.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part about digital that I'll just comment on, I read an article in an obscure little periodical almost 20 years ago. The title of that article said it all. This is before, Photoshop was in its infancy.
Right.
Nobody knew what it was. Digital cameras were a novelty. And the title of the article in the Whole Earth Almanac was "The End of Photography as Evidence of Anything." And what they pointed out back then was that it's possible to take somebody out of the picture and drop somebody else in.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible to move a pyramid on a landscape of Egypt to bring it into better position in the picture. It's possible to put a beautiful sunset into a horizon that wasn't there. It's possible to put the moon into... That is profoundly disturbing to me.
Where is your history? Where are the images that record your history? If they're so malleable,
yes,
and can be ultimately so contrived,
yes,
how do we visually go back? How will the future go back in time visually and be sure that what they see is really what was?
They can't.
They can't be sure.
It's the end of photography is the evidence of anything. It's really that. It's terribly sad. That's just the nature of a revolution. In order to move forward and have new opportunities, you're going to lose something.